Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. Maybe some of you know this about me, but I love learning about history. I think I always loved reading books about history and watching documentaries because selfishly it gave me a sense of who I was and where I came from or where I fit in with the grand scheme of things. My parents lived through plenty of history. They were the first generation of each of their families to go to college. And when they were in college, they experienced the student rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, civil rights movements, and they were a part of all of that. In my lifetime, I always remember there was all these events that kept happening that I kept thinking, gee, this is going to go down in history, like Richard Nixon, Watergate, Apollo 17, Roe v. Wade, Three Mile Island, Iran-Contra, Exxon Valdez, the LA riots, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, the 2008 housing bubble, and the election of the first African-American president. Historic events, all of them. And yet, despite the magnitude of all of those things, I never really felt like I'm living through history. One of these times that I always imagined everyone would know when they're in it, they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening right now. I can't believe we're going through this. Are we going to make it through it? I feel like we're doing that now. I think that with the 2016 election of Donald Trump, then the pandemic, and now this tipping point for a demand for racial justice. I think these three events have just come together to form the fact that we're living through history. I just know that the way these events are unfolding, I hope and I pray that once again our country comes out ahead, that we become better for it, that our Constitution holds up, that our values and the things that our Constitution says, those generic, vague, interpretable words hold true. And I hope we come out of this looking back and saying, oh my gosh, that was a tough time, but now we are so much better for it. So in that spirit, I asked my friend Shannon Furtak to talk to me about some of this stuff. We also had the bright idea to talk about musicians and how they comported themselves in other times of crises in the world. So you'll hear all about that. I hope you enjoy this. I'd love to hear feedback and thoughts from you guys on this because we might continue this conversation. So sit back. Here comes my friend Shannon Furtak and yours truly. Shannon, we're going to do this.
Let's do it.
We figured it out. Are you a friend or foe of technology? Let me ask you that question.
It depends on the day. Typically a friend.
Oh, I know. It's so necessary, but it's so time consuming, isn't it?
It really is, but once you get it and you learn it and you figure something out, it's very satisfying.
Satisfying. Just like doing this podcast. This is the 26th episode, and Shannon Furtak, I'm speaking with you tonight. And what do you want to say about yourself?
So we've been doing this podcast now for a while.
A year.
It's been a lot of fun. I've loved to listen to all of the guests and get to know a lot more about the music industry and about what you guys go through as working musicians, man. You guys are awesome.
That's true. But I asked you, tell me about you.
Me. So I feel like my life has become significantly less interesting recently, like everybody else, because I do nothing but sit at home, walk my dog, run,
and think about like the meaning of life, right?
Yep, that's right.
So I will say that I inspired myself to do this podcast in the beginning, but you actually encouraged me, which which made it happen. So thank you for that. And all the technology hoops that we ever jumped through, you're like, oh, no problem, we got this. So I thought it would be a good idea to start off just us doing an episode tonight.
What do you think about that? Let's do it. Let's talk about life. Let's talk about philosophy, the meaning of everything, pandemics.
Yes. You've got your Garth Brooks headset on. I love that.
That's right. And I love Garth Brooks, so it works for me.
For you? I mean, who doesn't if we really think about it?
I know, right? It's like saying I like Willie Nelson or I like the Beatles. Who doesn't like those?
You know what? My mother keeps calling me. Watch, I'm going to put her on speakerphone and talk to her. Let's see.
Okay.
Hi, Mom.
Oh, hi, honey. I got to talk to every one of my kids today, either in person or by phone, and I just needed to make it 100%.
You saved the best for last, right?
I saved the best for last.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm good. Guess what? That's on record because right now I'm recording a podcast with Shannon, and I put you on speakerphone, so now you're it's on record.
Oh, my God. Honey, let you go do that. Hi, Shannon.
All right. We'll call you later. Okay.
Okay, good. Bye.
All right. Where were we?
Your mom rocks. I'm just going to put that out there.
She does. She rocks in her own particular way. So we had an idea tonight, you and me, and we wanted to talk about a lot of things, but one thing in particular, we wanted to sort of put our own current situation in some sort of context. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the world knows we're in the middle of the novel coronavirus pandemic, and it's affecting people from all walks of life. And the thing is, I can't help but think of performers, specifically musicians. I mean, your guys' livelihood depends on crowds gathering in tight spaces, right?
Well, if you're lucky, yes.
So, and I mean, I know a lot of working musicians sometimes struggled before COVID. I mean, it's a tough mm-hmm. industry. And I can't imagine the hardship that working musicians are facing right now because they can't perform. I mean, a lot of states have requirements. You can't have gatherings of more than 10 people. So,
right. I see the real fallout from the pandemic is like now we're all trying to do live stream concerts. There's nothing worse than those. I got to tell you, it's like it continues the trajectory of where we were already going. I mean, I think they're going to figure out a way for this to be really cool eventually. But I feel like now we're in the silent movies. Do you remember when movies were, well, I don't know if you remember, but I remember in 1927 when movies were first invented and nobody would care what the movie was. They would just like be so in awe of the process, right? That right. Everyone was jumping into making and watching movies. So now, I mean, this is completely a stretch, but all I'm saying is the live stream concerts are the silent movies of our era because they're so low-fi. They're low budget and they're like super hard to watch.
But I mean, people are trapped at home, so our standards have also dropped, you know, for what's entertaining and what's funny. So
that's perfect. Oh, God. Do you really think our standards have dropped?
I mean, I can't speak for you. Mine have.
Yeah, mine too. I wave to when I am outside, I wave to everybody.
I mean, I definitely have been engaging the mailman in conversation. When I drink a cold beer, I'm like, this is the life. This is the greatest thing ever.
Well, to be fair,
Didn't you always say that, pandemic or no pandemic?
Yeah, but usually I wasn't on my couch when it happened. You know, it'd be a cool bar with my friends. I'd be like, oh, this is so right. good, especially now that it's warm out.
All right, let's put a positive, like, I'm going to play your part right now, and let's put a positive spin on the pandemic. What do we like, not the pandemic, but what do we like about our current situation?
So I like, for me personally, I'm actually speaking with my family more frequently, which mm-hmm. is nice. It's nice to kind of, we've had weekly Zoom meetings. You know, it's nice to keep in touch with everybody. And I've been doing a lot of outdoor running, which is good.
Oh, yeah, and that's good.
One thing I really noticed is I see a lot of families playing together. And I've always been an outdoor runner. Mm-hmm. And I did not see that before.
I've been reading books more. Like, there's been several things that have been on my bucket list for the past 10 years that, because I was on a hamster wheel, probably like a lot of people, that I couldn't do any of the basic, simple things I wanted to do, which was like, oh, pay attention to something for 2 or 3 hours, read a book, and not have to have 10 million places to go. So, like, you see families playing together. It's true. I've been talking to my family members a lot more often and sort of in more substantive ways. Like, we don't talk about, oh, I'll see you next week. And that, we talk about actual things, not making plans. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's kind of nice that there's not the FOMO factor. Like, you know,
did you say the Cuomo factor?
No, I said the FOMO factor.
Did you say the homo factor?
No, I mean, I do like both of those things, but the FOMO factor is the fear of missing out. So, you know, there's some Friday nights where I go out because I don't want to miss out. And what I'd really like to do is stay home because I'm tired from the end of a long week. But right. I go because, and I always end up having fun and I'm glad I went. But now I can just kind of stay home, chill out, and nothing's really going on. So that FOMO factor doesn't kick in. You're not wondering, what else could I be doing right now?
Totally. Good point. Question for you. What I've struggled with. Like, I've had many moments in the past 2 months that I am just so happy. Like, literally, I feel so happy because I'm literally working in my garden. Like I said, reading a book, picking up my guitar. And then all of a sudden I feel, I don't want to say guilty, but I get hit with this knowledge of the fact of so many people suffering right now. And it's a hard, I can't bring those two things together. Like, how can I be having peace and enjoyment when so many other people are on the complete opposite side of that spectrum? What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, you're right that we're all stuck at home, and that stinks in a lot of ways. And it's good in a lot of ways. But the underlying thing is that, you know, 101,000 Americans have died, and more of them have been sickened. And people are, you know, on vents for 25 days, 45 days. And, you know, they have long lasting effects that might not ever go away because of this virus. And it's kind of hard to reconcile our petty complaints and then, you know, our small joys and then think about that. It's tough, but it's kind of like when anybody dies, you know, or when anybody's sick, it sucks, but we're still here. So what are we going to do?
I know. I remember when my grandpa died a long time ago, my grandmother was like, oh, I just feel so guilty if I eat a sandwich or a tomato salad. And if it tastes good, she goes, I feel bad. You know, I get that. Do you get that?
Sure. Totally.
Oh, the crux. Oh, what a thing it is to be a human, right? All right. So we decided, you and me, that we wanted to put this in some sort of context. And so we each picked a plague and we each tried to find out what did musicians do during other plagues. Okay. So let's start there. And then maybe when we go through all that, maybe then we can revisit musicians, what are they doing now?
Okay. That sounds
so
good.
Who goes first? Let's flip a coin here. Okay. I'll flip this this Sacagawea silver dollar. Head or feet?
Feet.
Feet, you win. Okay, you go first.
All right. So just like back in my college days, I took the assignment and changed it a little bit. So, you know, we've been hearing a lot of comparisons of the current pandemic to the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. That was the last major pandemic that really affected many countries in the world. That pandemic infected 500 million people, and it killed 50 million people worldwide. So it was deadlier than coronavirus, at least so far. Mm-hmm. But it made me start to wonder what happened to performers 100 years ago when the pandemic hit.
So we're talking 1917, 1918, and yeah, we're talking even before. Was that before the radio? Yeah.
Oh, that didn't come up in my research.
Let's Google Marconi.
We'll guess it was before the radio, and then we'll get emails later.
I think it was before the radio. Yeah. It was definitely before the TV. It was definitely before the radio. Maybe. Okay, go ahead. Sorry. Keep going.
That's okay. So the pandemic did shut down public gatherings, just like our current pandemic has shut down public gatherings for us. And I really expected to go into this research topic and find a ton of information on the interwebs, but there was surprisingly little out there. Hmm. There was definitely an industry that the pandemic affected pretty drastically, but it wasn't the music industry. I'll get to that in a second, but here's just a few quick stats from what happened in the 1918 pandemic with the music industry. And so I got some of my information for this from the CDC.gov, AmericanOrchestras.org, the New York Times, PBS.org, and a cool website called Deadline.com, which I think it's like a play on Headline.com, but I'm totally guessing on that. Don't quote me.
Sure, why not?
So according to a 1918 issue of Billboard. Yeah, Billboard was around in 1918. Maybe radio was, we don't know.
I'm already impressed, just so you know. Okay, go ahead.
So the entire theater industry was paralyzed by the Spanish flu, which was what caused it, which was the pandemic of 1918. And again, that mirrors what's happening to the live performance industry today. Symphony concerts were put on hold due to quarantines on the East Coast and in some Midwestern cities.
Same as now.
Right. And what was interesting, which also is the same as now, is there were a lot of places that just didn't shut down. They just wouldn't. Hmm. So, but what happened with those places was when the shows actually happened, people got sick. So concert goers never knew who would be sickened. Sometimes it was the conductor. Sometimes it was the entire orchestra. So
wait, are you telling me? This is not funny.
No, I'm not being funny. This is true.
But by the way, a conductor during a performance would get sick?
No, like the conductor would get sick. So people would go to the performance and there wouldn't be a conductor. Maybe there would just be a singer. Maybe the singer would be gone.
Oh. It's like the new thing. They have the SoFar concerts. Do you know about that? It's
no.
Like you join. Yes, you do, because I played one and you were there.
Yes, I do know
people
that.
People sign up for a house concert, and they don't know who's going to be there performing for them, sort of like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So it was totally like that, but, you know, they had, back in 1918, they probably had to, like, put a corset on and, like, 15 layers of makeup and powder, because bathing was different. But, yeah, so probably just like that, but a little bit different. So sadly, there was a young soprano named Belle Godschalk. She died after contracting influenza. And she was kind of like a local hero during the war efforts, because this, remember, was right after the war, too. So she volunteered to work at Bethlehem Steel. She was kind of a badass woman.
Did you say Bethlehem Steel, which is right here in Buffalo, New York?
Well, but she did the one in Pennsylvania. So
fine. That's still okay.
Okay. Yeah. And she toured troop encampments, and she ended up getting sick after singing 7 times in a single day at Camp Dix in Jersey. And then, unfortunately, she died. Oddly, there was even less information on what happened to pop music during the pandemic. So, like, orchestras were definitely affected, operas and things like that. But jazz was just starting to happen at mm-hmm. this time. So there were records that indicated that early jazz bands canceled some tours. There were several songs titled the Influenza Blues that were published as sheet music as the result of the pandemic.
Really?
So I think the reason there's such, you know, sparse information out there
is because everybody died that was trying to report on it.
Right. Well, not necessarily, but the you're actually onto a good point because the pandemic had a surprisingly temporary and minor effect on the long-term health of the music industry because of just that. It was so fast. It moved super quickly. It was extra lethal. But because it, you know, unlike now where, you know, COVID, you might be sick for 14 days before you even know you're sick. Right. You got the flu and you got super sick and then you either got better or you didn't.
Right.
So, as soon as the outbreak eased, musical life just went back to normal. And a Musical America columnist estimated the financial losses at $5 million. And in today's money, that's about $86 million. According to the New York Times, the Met alone stands to lose that much money. And that's if it's able to open this fall.
Wait, so you're saying that during the Spanish flu of 1918, today's dollars, the music industry lost $86 million. Is that what you said?
Yep. Yep.
And you're saying one venue today, same dollars, yep. dollar to dollar, one venue stands to lose the same amount.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So
it's crazy.
It is crazy. And it's scary to think of that, you know, but I think there's a lot more people. Things are more expensive, I guess. And I don't know. I think we rely on stuff like that a lot more. You know, there's so much more of it than there was back then.
That's a good point. That's true. And when you say the music industry of 1918, they're really, the industry looked pretty much nothing like what it does today. So it wasn't really like an industry, like a banking industry at that point, right?
It was like a little baby industry.
Correct. It was like a little tiny sprout coming up from a seed, right?
That's right. All right. So now, do you want to guess which industry was changed significantly and forever?
Oh my gosh, I love games like this. Do I want to guess which industry was changed significantly and forever? Can I get three guesses and maybe one hint?
Well, why don't you...
Wait, can we do 20 questions? Like,
we could. I could give you one big hint.
No, I don't want a big hint. Let's try.
I'll give you two small hints.
No hints. 20 questions, yes or no.
Okay, sounds good.
Is this industry an entertainment industry?
Yes.
Is it the movies?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, that was two questions. Okay.
Yes, and no hints.
No hints. Yes. And it's, you kind of already brought this up already, so that's why it was extra funny when you were talking about movies before, and I'm like, oh, little spoiler.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. So the 1918 pandemic basically just upended the film industry. It led to the establishment of the studio system, and that still dominates Hollywood today. Studios basically gained control over movie theaters. Hollywood was essentially created.
Okay. Can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but why? Like, how did the studio system become created? Was it because of sound stages and people were more enclosed and away from each other, or
what? No, it's a little more insidious than that. Mm. It's so basically what happened was most American movie theaters were closed between 2 to 6 months because of the flu outbreak.
Okay.
And it wasn't like there was a bunch of Regal movie theaters or AMCs or Flicks or whatever is, you know, the big theaters. Most theaters were mom and pop operations. So a lot of these proprietors were already struggling, mm-hmm. and they lost essentially everything when they were forced to close for that long. So what happened was theaters started closing left and right, and this guy named Adolf Zucker, mm-hmm. He had the foresight to realize that if he got control of the theaters, he could control the entire industry.
Oh my God, distribution.
Yes. So sort of like another guy with the name Zucker that we're not going to talk about today.
Wait, but anyway. Are you talking about Zucker with a something like a glacier on the end?
Yes.
Okay.
You always pick up what I put down. Look at that.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's just talk about the history of Adolf Zucker. He was born in Hungary in 1873. He was orphaned by the age of 7. None of this stopped him from developing a sharp business acumen. He came to New York when he was 16. He got a job making $2 a week sweeping floors in a fur store.
Oh, God.
I know. He switched industries, so don't worry. He studied English. Eventually, he did open his own fur store before he gave up the fur entirely.
Hmm.
So he made a bunch of investments, and he kind of dabbled in a bunch of things, I think like an early arcade type thing. And then he bought into a Nickelodeon theater. So that was his foot in the door in the movie biz. So by 1918, he was already making movies, but he also wanted to control how they were distributed, like you said, and how they were shown. So this is when he kind of starts to suck a little bit.
The Zucker was a sucker?
He was, yeah. So he knew if he took control of all aspects of the film industry, he'd be able to effectively eliminate competition from independent filmmakers. And a lot of those indies were women and minorities. So he was...
Wait a minute. Not only is Zucker a sucker, but I also think he's a fucker the way he's acting right now. First the fur and now this.
I know. We don't like him very much at all.
Oh.
So he eliminated that competition and he silenced the voices of these women, minorities in the industry. And that was his plan all along, but the pandemic just made it easy for him because so many they were ready to sell the theater for a song at that point.
Just so you know, I hate this story.
I know. It kind of sucks.
All right, let's keep going.
I wish I could say there was a happy ending. But so basically, Zucker became the head of what was called Famous Players, but it later became, do you want to guess?
Okay, yes, I do, because I might know this. Can I have 3 guesses?
Yes.
Famous Players became, it was not United Artists, MGM.
No.
Warner Brothers.
No.
Famous Players, Goldman Sachs.
No.
Okay, I give it
Paramount.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
So Paramount, then was able to control theaters, films, and it really stayed that way for a long time. I mean, every time you watch a movie, you usually see one of a few big names. Paramount, MGM. I mean, those are the two that I think of the most.
United Artists.
MGM is the lion, right?
Yes. Roar.
So now with that said, so that's the end of my 1918 story. So what do we think could happen to the film industry because of today's pandemic? Well, a couple of different things. So several studios have already released films straight to streaming services, just skipping the normal big theatrical release, which, I mean, I don't know about you, but
yep.
I will tell you why I never go to the movies. I don't really watch much TV or many movies to begin with, but I really hate going to the theater. Number one, the movie starts at a certain time. Things always come up, you're on a schedule then, you're on somebody else's schedule. You have to, act a certain way, you have to be quiet. You don't want to cry your eyes out in a movie when you're surrounded by people. They just came out with those reclining chairs, which is awesome. But before that, you kind of had to sit up ramrod straight and it wasn't comfortable. Right.
Ramrod.
Yeah. So, and if you have to pee, you can't pause the movie, right? So that
you know what? What generation are you? Are you a millennial?
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
I'm an elder millennial.
Keep going.
Eldest possible millennial. So a couple big films. It started with Trolls World Tour. And according to Esquire.com, which is where I got some more information, they're going to say, like, they're saying that people are going to study this movie, Trolls World Tour, because it was the first one that basically completely skipped the theatrical release and went straight to a streaming service. And then that was followed by The Invisible Man and Just Mercy. Mm. So The New Yorker, which is another awesome magazine.
Yes.
Basically said, it's impossible to know whether the opportunity to garner new home viewing audience during the current crisis will be as short-lived as the chance to rescue production companies was in late 1918.
Oh, there's the connection.
There's the connection. So The New Yorker suspects that it'll be longer lasting. And they had a whole article about this. It was pretty interesting, so I recommend checking it out. But it's basically, back in the day, you didn't have another option, right? So when things opened back up and you could now go to the theater again or go to a concert,
off you go.
Those were your options. But now everyone's like, I could just do it at home, which some of us already knew that. Some of us were like me. I'm a big fan of just, if I'm going to watch something, I want to watch it in my bed, really, or on my couch.
So that is so interesting. I had the opportunity when I was on a Zoom call with our mutual friend Holly a couple weeks ago, and we had the opportunity to speak to a couple actors, and we asked them how can they do love scenes with social distancing, and and they said they really can't. So like if you can't have 10 people, you can have 10 people together, you can't have big productions like a 50, you can't have a big epic sweeping production for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the only way they really could is if they did 14 days of quarantine, tested everybody at the end of that time to make sure nobody was positive, and then basically made them stay on set.
Wow. That would work, like, in a big way. Like, imagine Game of Thrones if they tried to do that right now.
Yeah, well, but I mean, that's their coworkers. Imagine being stuck for however long a movie takes to make, months, sometimes a year, with your coworkers, and you can't go do anything else, go home to your family.
If the jury from OJ could do it, I think the actors could do it too. Remember how long they had to be sequestered for so long? Okay, so.
But look how that ended. It wasn't a good ending.
True. Good point. All right. So movies are going to be, we don't know what. Concerts are going to be, we don't know what.
There's so many unknowns. I mean, it's all going to depend on, you know, we're sitting in New York, so we're going by the slow phased openings. We can watch the other states, you know, and see what's happening there. And I mean, maybe eventually we'll be able to have a normal concert again. Will everybody be wearing masks?
In my estimation, in the past 10 years, concerts have been not about the concert. It's been about, you know, like, just if say you're talking a big, huge stadium concert, still people are going there for the music. I get that. But everyone's like filming it on their phones, texting on their phones. Like, they're not really there. I have this theory, like, if you want to experience something, you have to be present and single-minded. Like, that might be a generational thing. I don't know. But I just feel like, you know, like people have been taking a lot of things for granted. And in a way, I'm including myself, we sort of had this coming to us. If we have so many options, so many choices living in the United States, with so lucky to be like in this culture that has so much to consume. Do you know what I mean? As a consumer society, like, we have taken it all for granted and we've taken it all to the extreme. So the pendulum sort of swung the other way. Now we're like, boom, guess what? You're back in the 1930s. You got to like live in your house with your family and cook at home. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally, it's a whole different world. I mean, I already worked at home, so that part didn't change for me, but I definitely am cooking a lot more, drinking a lot more. And I mean, I'm really having more meaningful interactions.
Yeah. And like the whole commuting thing, by the way, like I spent probably 10 hours a week driving in my car, and now I'm doing all the same work. Maybe not 100. It's not the same as face-to-face things, just like a concert, just like anything. But there is something to be said for how stupid we all were for driving all over Kingdom Come all the time. Like our world got bigger. Like keep it. There's something to be said for a town, like a walkable town. Do you know what I mean? And like,
yeah. And I mean, I like to think that it wasn't really us, the people who are, you know, making us drive to work for a job that could be done from home. You know, I was of the mind that you couldn't work from home, right? And then mm-hmm. I had applied for a job and got it, and it was a work from home job. And I was like, how is this going to work? You know, how am I going to motivate myself to do work when I'm at home? But it was so mm-hmm. easy. It was right. so much easier than I thought it would be. You know, I'm on the same schedule I was always on with my commuting job or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a lot more done because there's a lot fewer interruptions.
There's a theory in business. Oh, gosh. I want to say I might get this wrong and my dad would be very upset, but it's like a Parkinson theory or something, that work expands to fill a vacuum. So when you're in an office and you know you have to be there for 8 days, all the bullshit tasks that are actually pointless get assigned to you and you have to do to fill your day.
Right.
You need to have time for other things to make you a better person, more enriched, more full, you know? So I think the office jobs, if you consider the commute and the bullshit, that counts for probably 75% of your day, don't you think?
Yeah. And it's just unnecessary stress. It's completely unnecessary. I mean, for some jobs, you have to be there. You know, if you're touching products and, you know, interacting with the actual components of a machine or whatever, you know, right. that's something different. But so many office jobs, administrative jobs, you know, they could just be yeah. done remotely.
I think the essential worker type jobs should be bolstered. They should be put in the position where they should have been already. I mean, in the pay and the sort of respect, right? This is a good segue into my discussion about the Black Plague. But people who are workers have lost their status in this country, and that is tragic. They need to be replaced up where they were respected, right? Just like, yes, police, fire, EMT, grocery workers, post office workers, like garbage workers, like the sanitation people, everybody who makes this society move, they need to be respected. And we had such a hierarchy in this, the white collar thing. There's no difference in how you should respect those people. And I think maybe, hopefully, we see how necessary certain jobs are. And the bubble of these imaginary jobs hopefully would be popped. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, if there's a job that needs doing, that job should first earn its worker a living wage, no matter what, no exceptions.
Yes. Correct.
No one should be working 40 hours a week and needing to get benefits.
Correct.
That's absolutely insane, especially when the profiteering of CEOs has just gone through the roof. It's increased exponentially in the past 30 years, thanks to trickle down economics, not actually trickling down to shit. But yeah, I definitely agree. You know, a lot of people go to the grocery store and maybe they don't acknowledge their cashier, or, you know, maybe they get frustrated when one of the workers can't find something for them. And that's just got to stop, you know,
everybody. I think that got flipped pretty quick. That's if we want to look on the bright side of this, do you know what I mean? People say, oh my God, thank you, cashier. Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
For the first time ever in your life, you think that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, in management, I think, is seeing that too, you know, because I'm sure there were a lot of people who were maybe hesitant to come to work. Maybe they're immunocompromised. Maybe they live with someone elderly, you know, and the people that are able to go to work and that are willing to go to work every day, now all of a sudden they're getting, the manager is getting their back when the customer is yelling at them instead of, you know, taking them aside and saying, you really have to do better, because they're doing the best they can.
That's a good point. Yes. I'm going to do a quick pivot left, and now we're going to switch to the Black Plague. Is that okay?
I'm so excited to learn about the Black Plague.
Okay. First of all, can you hear me okay?
I can. It's perfect.
Okay. All right. Here's what we need to know now, but get ready, buckle your seatbelt, because this might be a long ride. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I got my information from Wikipedia, from a blog from WQXR called Weird Classical, the History of Black Death Music Parties, and from somebody's thesis, an essay on death's influence on the music of the 14th century. Okay.
All right.
Okay, so let's talk first about this. The Black Death was the most fatal pandemic recorded in human history, resulting in deaths of up to 75 to 200 million people in Eurasia, North Africa, and it peaked in Europe from 1347 to 1351. So we're talking in 4 years. Up to 200 million people died from this, okay?
Wow.
The plague created religious, social, and economic upheavals with profound effects on the course of European history. And the thing I want to say about that is our pandemic that we're having right now, I believe, is going to have profound effects on, I don't think religious, my opinion. I think not religious, but social and economic effects. It's going to have a big effect on many civilizations.
Okay? I would agree with you. I think religion today is a lot less prevalent than it was probably back then.
In the 1347 year, class of 1347.
I mean, from what I've heard about 1347, they were way more religious than we are.
They were. I was there. Okay. The Black Death most likely originated in Central Asia or East Asia, from where it traveled along the Silk Road. Do you know about the Silk Road?
I know nothing about it.
It was like the main trail, not a trail, but it was the path that linked Asia to Eastern Europe. So it was like the superhighway. It was like the internet of the 1300s.
Okay.
It was how they took spices and silk and things from Asia and sent them over to Europe, and Europe sent, I don't know if it went both ways, maybe kind of like now. Okay. Anyways, that's what they call the Silk Road. And so they think that the disease followed that way. And they think it was most likely carried by fleas living on the black rats that traveled on merchant ships, spreading throughout the Mediterranean and reaching Africa, Western Asia, and the rest of Europe, including Constantinople and my people, Sicily, and Italy. Current evidence indicates that once it got onshore, the Black Death was in large part spread by, are you ready? Drum roll, human fleas.
What?
Yes.
People humans had fleas? Fleas.
Of course they did.
Oh, my
yes.
God.
Yes.
It's just thinking about it.
Yes. And which caused pneumatic plague and the person-to-person contact via aerosols, which pneumatic plague enables.
Is an aerosol like a droplet?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I know what little icon is flashing in your head right now. It's that... Goddamn, why does everybody have to show that picture of that virus blown up like all the time? Aren't you sick of that?
I mean, yeah, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
I like when they make it have a face.
I don't want to see it. I don't want to even see that at all. Like, don't make it bigger by blowing it up. All right, let's get back to the 1300s. According to medieval historian Philip Daylieder, it is likely that over 4 years, 45 to 50% of the European population died of the plague. Norwegian historian Ole Benediktau suggests that it could have been as much as 60% of the European population.
Good God.
In crowded cities, it was not uncommon for as much as 50% of the population to die. Half of Paris died. In Florence, they went from 120,000 inhabitants down to 50,000. At least 60% of the population of Hamburg, Germany, not New York, perished, and similar percentages throughout Europe. With such a large population decline from the plague, wages soared in response to a labor shortage. What do you think about that?
Silver lining?
Okay. On the other hand, in the quarter century after the Black Death in England, it is clear that many laborers, artisans, and craftsmen, those living from money wages alone, did suffer a reduction in real incomes owing to rampant inflation. Landowners were also pushed to substitute monetary rent for labor services in an effort to keep tenants.
Huh.
Think about that concept.
So basically, to increase wages, half the population has to die.
Yes. And if you can't pay your rent, you can work in your landlord's, be their housekeeper or something like that.
Oh my God.
Instead of your rent. Okay, look at this. Talk about a silver lining. Some historians believe that the innumerable deaths brought on by the plague cooled the climate by freeing up land and triggering reforestation.
Hmm.
Right?
So when humans are sick, the planet gets better, because that's happening now too.
Uh-huh. So yes, correct. You can do that line from point A to point B pretty clearly.
So we're a drain on the planet's resources. It's official.
Mm-hmm. I think I could agree with that statement. Now I'm going to move on to the weird classical history of Black Death music parties.
All right.
I'm just going to read from this blog, if you don't mind. And it says, folks in medieval Europe indulged themselves in the finer aspects of life. Because don't forget, the 1300s was the Renaissance.
Right.
Okay. Wines, beers, good music, and of course, raucous parties. Large groups of wanderers loudly singing songs. Okay, so that was, you know, the Chippewa of the 1300s.
I literally was going to say it sounds like Chippewa.
But remember, these people felt that death was inevitable because 5 out of 10 people were dying from this. So these people thought carpe diem, sort of, right? They thought death was inevitable. And in the end, everyone was just trying to evade it as best they could. In the process, the typical social order of medieval Europe completely broke down. As the social order was demolished and chaos ensued, musical form began to flourish in new territories. And this is when composers explored complex secular songs, big difference. Because before that, it was a lot of the music was written for the church, paid for by the church. So it was very religious, right? Or in the kings and stuff like that. But then the secular started to take over and the ballad became a form of music, which is actually, in my limited estimation, it's sort of like what popular songs in America are based on. Ballads, that's stanzas, that's stories, that's a chorus, okay? So it says music was increasingly a part of secular social fabric in European life, not just the religious part. The raucous rousers of the Black Death were no strangers to using music as a means of pure enjoyment. Some people chose to repent for their sins and some chose to carry lucky charms with them to ward off the disease. Because a lot of people thought that this disease was caused by literally astrology, like the planets lined up a certain way, or God was mad at them and it was a punishment. So some people tried to repent for their sins as a way to hopefully not get sick, but others abandoned religion and instead led lives of merriment. Indulging in the pleasures of life, these people sought parties wherever they could. So I'm thinking of right now the Ozarks over Labor Day weekend, right?
Yep.
And, you know, many other places where we're in Buffalo and our weather was hot, but if we had like this amazing, beautiful ocean, would we be tempted? Maybe we would. I don't want to judge people.
I mean, people have been crowding just our simple hiking trails that they had to close. So yeah, I think if we had, you know, an ocean front or an especially nice lake front, which I guess we kind of do in some places, that they probably would have been overwhelmed.
All right. So because so many people believed the end was nigh, they no longer cared to keep their belongings, and items like houses became common property. Partygoers would walk into any house and claim it as theirs because people no longer were concerned with property rights.
See, the democratic socialist in me thinks this is awesome, but the neat freak in me thinks this would be terrible.
Yeah, and the new homeowner in me thinks, hell no, give me the Fourth Amendment. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
Okay. But, I mean, it's like nobody's living there because everybody's dead. It's like, you know?
All right, let's keep going. Yeah.
There were some who abandoned society entirely, choosing to choosing to lock themselves away as the plague spread through the towns around them. In their isolated cabins, they distracted themselves from the death and destruction with fine wine and music.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think I want to just say one more little bit, and this is from yet another article. This is the guy Jason Stossel, who did an article called Essays on Death's Influence on the Music of the 14th Century. And he, let me just read this.
Okay.
Society, you might say not okay after you hear me read it, but here we go.
Okay.
Society threatened to disintegrate as parents abandoned their children. The unscrupulous profited from the dying and morals slipped. Still, the rest of the Decameron, it's a book, highlights the most perplexing aspects of the 14th century. Secluded in a palace outside of Florence, the band of men and women at the center of Decameron's narrative entertained themselves with stories, music, and dancing that explore the themes of the living, love, sex, friendship, society, and religion. In the long run, the Black Death's horrors were obscured and replaced by a more melancholic, personal, and emotional tone in art, sometimes descending into decadence. And, I read that, like, I guess there was a plague, like, when Shakespeare was writing, and there's some correlation between art thriving and societies not thriving. What do you think about that?
Well, it's sort of like if you think about, okay, Kurt Cobain, Chris Cornell, these are tortured souls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were absolute brilliant musical geniuses, right? Mm-hmm. So would they have been as good at their craft if they were thrilled all the time? Probably not.
I hear what you're saying. So what you're saying is suffering begets art.
It does.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, I don't know. I guess because it's such a strong feeling, you know, sadness, depression, when you're just morose, maybe you're inspired to create, to try and make yourself feel better, but also to express those feelings, you know, and share them. I mean, they're universal feelings, right? We've all been there.
Yes, that's what I was just going to say. That's the one thing. You might have different circumstance, but the feeling of sadness feels the same.
Right.
No matter who you are, where you're from, or even if you're like a pet, an animal, like sad is sad. Yeah. And is happy, happy. Like the feeling, yeah, peace is peace, right?
I mean, you could also say euphoria creates or begets art too.
Meuphoria creates art? Thank you.
You're welcome. But yeah, I mean, I think strong feelings, whether it's, you know, joy or sadness or pain, they're universal things that if you create something, somebody else out there is going to understand it.
Yes. Now, let me just go back to your euphoria point. And maybe this is genre, I'm sure this is genre specific, but like, I have never been good at writing songs when I'm happy. There's a whole like EDM and like dance music and like, of course that's, but for me, like some, when I'm not happy is when I'm more, when I'm better at writing.
Yeah. And I mean, we need songs for when we're depressed and sad and crying, you know, we need songs for when we're getting ready to go party or, you know, mm-hmm. dancing or out at the club or, you know, whatever, or right now just in your living room listening to happy music.
Right. By the way, one more point about the Black Plague. I forgot to say one thing. The doctors during that era, they would literally prescribe music to people.
Really?
Like they'd be like, all right, go home and play your lute.
Well, I mean, it makes sense. There's a medical correlation between your mental health and your physical health.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like when you were talking about how people were like, you know what, we're going to die anyway, we might as well just have fun. It just made me think of Imagine, you know, John Lennon's song. And maybe he was channeling that era when he was writing it. You know, because imagine no possessions, imagine like sharing all the world. And it's so hard to fathom us doing that right now. Just that our society is so structured and what's mine is mine. What's yours is yours. And, you know, if somebody walks on your property in some states, you're allowed to shoot them dead.
Oh God.
So it's definite. And I mean, obviously in order for a society to continue and thrive, you have to have some semblance of order.
Right.
You know, some laws are good. And, you know, it's really the bad people that cause the need for laws to begin with. But imagine a society, what would you do if you were going to die tomorrow and you knew it, you know? And why don't we live every day like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why don't we? But the thing is, I wouldn't want to live every day like that, though, because there's something to be said for boring, for being bored.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, as your wife had the best quote in the world, every day is not a carnival. And that has been my motto for the past 10 years, my life's motto. I'm like, every day is not a carnival. Relax. You don't have to do anything special today. Just relax, right?
Yeah. And I think it's just, you know, doing what you want, because a lot of times we do what we don't want to do. I mean, I like my job. My job's awesome. But a lot of people don't like their jobs, but they have to go to work because you have to make money because you have to pay rent or pay your mortgage or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you got to, if you were going to die tomorrow, who cares about your mortgage, right? So we can't live every day like that, because in reality, we're probably not going to die tomorrow. And come the 1st of June, we do have to pay our mortgages.
Yeah, it's a fine balance, isn't it?
It is. Happiness is finding that balance, right?
Yes. Or just happiness is realizing that you're not always going to be happy.
Yeah. And being okay with it.
Right. So we're 56 minutes. We should call this a day.
You know what I'm saying? For sure.
If anybody has any questions or comments for us, please call Shannon at 555-1212. Or you could email us at thegreatunsung@gmail.com. That is, please spell it, Shannon.
thegreatunsung@gmail.com.
That's right. So we think we're going to try this again, maybe in a couple days. and or no, let's say a week, because we're going to gather some information from some of our former guests, right?
Yeah. Or maybe you listening want to write us an email and tell us how you're coping, what you're doing.
Good one. Yes. How are you coping? What are you doing? And what are you happy about? Like, I'm happy about so many things. And what are you sad about? Like, I'm sad about the loss of life. I'm sad about all the people working so hard. I just hope now those thankless jobs are going to become respected. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The bus drivers and the, like, everybody that's so keeping the society going. When push comes to shove, what do? You turn to a poor person, right? Like in The Grapes of Wrath, that one scene, the guy goes into the little store and he's like, he doesn't have any money. He's got to buy like a head of lettuce or something for his family. And the lady behind the counter is like, you don't have any room left on your account. I can't give you this. She reaches down into her pocket. She gets a dime out and she says, here, I know you'll pay me back. So he could buy the food for his family for that soup that night or whatever.
Right.
And the point is, when you're down and out, who do you go to? A poor person.
Well, who makes the economy go? I mean, if this pandemic teaches us nothing else, it's that the workers control the economy. Billionaires and investors and Wall Street people are not making a difference right now. You know, nope. It's we the people. It's always been we the people. And we have a lot more power than we realize.
Correct. And by the way, we're such a big country with so many people that it's challenging. Because all the different states, we're such a diverse country. It's almost like if you go to Texas or California or New York or South Dakota, you might as well be going to Germany, France, Spain, Italy. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. Yep.
So that's kind of miraculous that we've been able to keep it together, I guess. And that's all because of the Constitution, which reminds me, tune in next time because Shannon and I are going to be taking a deep dive into the U.S. Constitution.
That sounds awesome. Let's do it.
All right. See you guys later. Bye, Shannon.
Bye, Elle.